Do you really wish to be caught between these hate-filled children when they start fighting again? Because they will. And even if they don't, you are anchored in what may be the last occupied human settlement in Aratzia. Any time you spend here is borrowed time. He allowed a moment to let his words sink in, knowing each skipper present had their own epic of survival to ponder, and that he was asking a great deal. I make no promises and offer no reassurances, he continued. Only a chance to join a fight that needs fighting.
How are we supposed to get there?
The Dalcian woman asked.
My coal bunker's barely a third full.
I don't have the reserves to make it out of the harbor, the Corventine added. We pool our resources, Eilmore told them. Gather together all the coal we have and decide how many bunkers we can fill. Meaning you intend some ships to be abandoned, the Corventine concluded.
Eilmore faced them, replying in a tone he hoped was both confident and regretful.
Yes.
This provoked an instant growl of protest, but he continued, voice loud enough to override the grumbling.
There are ships at anchor here in such poor repair, they'll never sail again. You all know this. Others are too frail and slow for any kind of war service. Their crews will be allocated to other ships. No sailor will be left behind.
Pox on this,
the Dalcian woman said, casting a dismissive hand at Hylmore and stomping towards the rail. She added something in her own tongue as she swung a leg over the side and began to scale the rope netting to her boat. Hylmore's Dalcian was rusty and imperfect, but this phrase was one he had heard often enough to translate. Corporate swine are always selling you shit and telling you it's gold. Hylmore resisted the urge to plead with them, as other captains quickly followed the Dalcian woman's example. He had neither the authority nor the power to compel them, and his conscience forbade making any false promises as to the likelihood of victory or any rich rewards. Had the situation been reversed, he had to admit that he might well have taken the same course. Therefore, it was surprising to find about half the captains still standing on the foredeck when the exodus had ended. The Corventine had remained, as had Captain Tidlow.
Not all my crew will come, the Blue Hunter skipper mused, fingers playing through his lengthy beard. But I reckon I can talk maybe two-thirds of them round.
My crew will follow my orders, the Corventine asserted. They're all former sailors in the Imperial Navy, as am I, and we're very tired of running.
The subsequent discussion with the other skippers confirmed similar sentiments, although with one important proviso.
We can't fight without weapons, the Corventine said.
He had introduced himself as Captain Gherkin of the merchant vessel Holloway, a swift three-paddle clipper built for the tea trade. Although not a bloodburner, Eilmore knew she would make perhaps the most valuable addition to his makeshift flotilla.
Weapons are being produced in a manufactory in Verestia, he assured them. New weapons of far greater power and accuracy than anything we have.
Lots of sea twixt here and there, Tidlow pointed out. Blues too, I'd reckon. We don't have your pet monster to guide us anymore.
I'm reliably informed the Blues are concentrated in Verestian and Corventine waters, meaning we should have an unmolested journey, at least until we arrive.
Hylmore clasped his hands together, briskly moving on before Tidlow asked him to elaborate. In actuality, he had no such intelligence regarding the whereabouts of any Blue Drakes, but a lack of certainty was an obstacle just now, and a modicum of dishonesty a necessity.
I shall require full manifests of all cargo, crew, and supplies for each of your ships. My chief engineer will conduct a thorough inspection of all vessels and will have the final word on what sails and what doesn't.
In all, Chief Boswell advised that some 18 vessels out of a total of 22 were in a sufficient state of repair to make an ocean voyage to Verestia, Unfortunately, the parlous state of the combined fuel stocks meant they had only enough coal for a dozen vessels.
12's better than one, Chief, Eilmore said.
Turns out there's a jewel in the dung pile,
Bosware went on, handing Eilmore one of the manifests. The name ECT Endeavour was scrawled at the top of the sheet in labored Mandanorian, above a crew list of only 6 names, and a cargo schedule containing mostly worthless sundries, but one item of considerable importance.
One full flask of red, Eilmore read.
She's a blood burner, the chief confirmed. Fast Eastern Conglomerate mail packet, working the route between Dalcia and Aratia. Crew told me all about their misfortunes when I went to look her over. Turns out a blue gave them a terrible mauling south of the Razor Sea. Lost their skipper, company bloodblessed, and most of their mates. Somehow they managed to sail her all the way here. The upper works are a mess, but the hull and the mechanicals are sound.
She'll need crew, Eilmore said. A bloodblessed and a captain.
What do you think? He asked Zenida a short while later. They had taken a boat to the Endeavour, the sparse crew welcoming them aboard with a refreshing display of relief and gratitude.
Thought we was gonna just rot here,
the bosun said, apparently the only senior sailor left on board. He was a burly fellow, but young for his rank, Eilmore suspecting he had earned it mostly through physical strength, and, judging by the way the other crewmen avoided his eye, no small amount of intimidation. Still, he had managed to salvage his ship and sail it for hundreds of miles to a safe harbor, which indicated at least some facility for leadership.
Nothing some decent carpentry and a lick of paint wouldn't fix, Zenida said,
voice rich in irony as she surveyed the scorched and partly shattered wheelhouse.
I'll assign you a work crew, Eilmore told her.
Me?
She stared at him in bafflement for a second, then frowned as realization dawned.
A new command, she mused,
a mix of wariness and anticipation playing over her features as she once again looked the ship over.
Who will fire the Viables engine?
Lieutenant Sigarol or Mr. Torkreek?
Assuming either of them actually survives to make it here.
There is at least one other bloodblessed in this port. In extremis, I'm sure I can persuade her to join us.
Persuade or kidnap?
I did say in extremis.
You always were a ruthless man, Captain.
She let out a soft laugh as she scanned the ugly mess of the vessel's upper deck. The Endeavour was a one-stack, two-paddle ship with a narrow hull.
Built for speed, not comfort,
Eilmore's grandfather would have said.
I had such fine hopes for my next ship, Zenida commented. I even had the plans drawn up. She would have been called the Flame Heart, fastest ship afloat, and one day Akina would have been her captain.
That can all still happen, Eilmore said, when this war's over.
Perhaps.
Zenida gave a wistful laugh.
The plans would need to be redone. I suspect all future ships will be propeller-driven like the Superior. We stand at the dawn of a new age, Captain. Let's hope we live to see it, eh?
We will, Eilmore said, voice flat with a certainty they both knew to be false.
Zenida nodded and cast a final glance over the ship.
I accept my new commission, she said, but with one condition. I'm not staying here.
Eilmore ducked to let the spanner Keena had thrown sail over his head, making a loud clang as it collided with the engine room bulkhead. The girl's grease-besmirched face was bunched in fury as she reached into her toolbox for another missile.
Akina!
Zenida said, voice hard with a rarely used parental authority. She stepped between her daughter and Eilmore, snaring the girl's wrist in a tight grip as she drew her arm back for another throw.
This is my wish, not his, she said in quietly spoken Verestian.
Are you my daughter?
She tugged Akina's arm, the wrench in her grasp falling to the deck.
Are you my crew?
Akina stared up at her mother. The fury vanished from her face to be replaced with naked fear.
I should be with you, she said in a hoarse whisper. Don't leave me here, please, Mama.
Zenita released Akina's arm, Almor seeing how she resisted the impulse to pull her close.
Daughters obey their mothers, she said. Crew obey their captains. You are ordered to stay here and follow our sea brother's instructions. You are his crew now.
Akina pressed herself to her mother, arms enclosing her waist, the only sob Hylmore had ever heard from her escaping her lips, and she clung on tight. Feeling like an intruder, he turned away, moving to the hatchway, then pausing as a low whistle sounded from the speaking tube.
Signal from the crow's nest, sir,
Talmont's tinny voice reported.
Drake in sight overhead.
It's definitely a red, sir, Steelfine said, spyglass raised high as he tracked the winged silhouette across the sky. Just one, though.
That'll change soon enough,
Hylmore heard Scrimshine mutter at his back. He scanned the surrounding ships, seeing the multitude of sailors crowding the decks, faces all turned skyward.
It's just out of rifle range, Steelfine went on. That mad contractor marksman might have been able to take it down. The rest of us would just be wasting ammunition. We could try a shot with the pivot gun.
Also a waste of ammunition, number one, Almore said. It's already seen us in any case.
From his conversations with Clay, he was well aware that what one Drake saw, so did the white. It knows this ship, he thought, and now it knows where we are.
Signal lamp, sir,
Talmont said, pointing to a blinking light on one of the neighboring ships. It was a broad-beamed one-paddle freighter with Dalcian lettering on the hull. Hylmore could see the diminutive pirate captain at the lamp, signaling in plain code, I changed my mind. Within minutes, more lamps began blinking on other ships, and soon it appeared every vessel in the harbor was sending out variations of the same message.
It appears, Almore said. We have a fleet, after all.
Chapter 31 Clay. He pulled Chris close, trying to cover them both with his duster. A blast of heat prickled his skin as the black's flames swept over the green leather. Then the heat abruptly vanished, and the ground shuddered as something heavy came to earth nearby, Clay grimacing as a drake's roar filled his ears. It was different from the challenging screech of the black that had just tried to roast them. This was the deep, throaty roar of a mature male, and he had heard it before. He drew the duster back to find himself bathed in shadow. A large claw scraped the earth close to his head, and a glance upwards revealed a massive scaled ribcage that swelled and contracted as the beast above let out another roar. It was answered by a chorus of screeches from the other drakes, the huge shape shifting above Clay and Chris, the air whooshing as its tail whipped and its wings flared. Clay saw the other two blacks spread their own wings, but in obvious supplication rather than challenge. They lowered their heads and backed away, emitting small, low-pitched grunts as they retreated. The third black, however, was not so easily cowed. Clay ducked as another blast of flame rushed between the male black's rear legs. The duster protected them from the worst of it, but not all. Clay letting out a shout as fire licked at the back of his left hand, scorching the flesh. The shadow and the claw disappeared as the male black leapt, the ground trembling when it landed a split second later. Clay looked up from his scorched hand to see the two drakes locked in a fierce, if brief, struggle. The larger male had the smaller female pinned beneath his forelegs, jaws clamped on her throat. She let out a defiant roar, earning a fierce, punishing shake of the head from the male. He held her there for several seconds, jaws slowly tightening until she grew still and let out a low-pitched grunt. The male released her, folding his wings and settling into a resting crouch, tail twisting placidly. He didn't look at the female as she rose and darted forward to retrieve the egg she had been offered. Clutching the prize in her jaws, she cast a final glance of deepest antipathy at Clay and Chris, then turned about and launched herself into the air after a short sprint. Clay turned at the snap of wings, seeing the other two drakes following suit.
"Here,"
Chris said, taking out a vial of green and tipping half the contents over his hand. Clay took a moment to let the product banish his pain before approaching the male, having motioned for Chris to stay put. He moved into the beast's eyeline, extending a tentative hand to smooth the scales of his foreleg. Lutheron let out a low rumble as the human skin met his own, the muscle shuddering much as it had done back on the Superior the night Clay sent him away.
"Hello again, big fella," Clay said. "I gotta say, it's awful nice to be remembered."
Lutheron lowered his head, letting out a rumble of greeting that took on a much more ominous tone when his gaze flicked to Chris. She stood at a decent remove, the black crystal hovering before her and producing a familiar tinkle as it expanded.
"What are you doing?" Clay asked.
"What we came here for," she said,
gaze locked on Lutheron. Clay saw that she held a vial of red in her hand.
"It needs energy to activate," she said.
"Be better if I did it," Clay said, moving towards her. "He knows me.
And hates me."
Chris's eyes were wide, features the rigid mask of one who has recently escaped death.
"All of them do. If I do this, perhaps they won't."
Her words were drowned out as Lutheron let out another roar, wings flaring once more as he sank into a threat stance. Clay noted how the drake's eyes were focused on the now fully expanded crystal. It revolved slowly, resembling some kind of hole in space, in the way it exuded no light, save for a small glimmer on the tips of its spikes.
"Stop," Clay said. "He doesn't like it."
"He doesn't have to."
Lutheron gave a sudden intake of breath, followed by the throaty rattle that told of disgorging combustible gas. Clay lunged towards Chris, dragging her aside. Lutheron let out a fierce and sustained jet of flame, aimed not at Chris, but at the crystal. With Chris's focus distracted, the stream of black keeping it in the air vanished and it fell to the ground, a dark smudge amidst the torrent of flame. Lutheron's fire died, leaving a sizable blaze in its wake. Clay squinted through the flames to make out the jagged shape of the crystal. It seemed to be completely undamaged, the center of it still as dark as before, but the spikes glowing brighter. Lutheron evidently found this unacceptable and began to take another large breath.
"Don't!"
Clay shouted, moving to stand in front of the black, arms raised.
"Clay!"
Chris said.
"It's active!"
"What?"
He turned, blinking in confusion at the sight that confronted him. The crystal hung in the air once more, risen from the flames. Its jagged spikes now glowed with a fierce white light, though its center retained the same absolute darkness.
"You doing this?"
he asked Chris.
"No. The fire. Energy, remember?"
Clay took a step back as the crystal drifted closer, finding himself backing into Lutheron. The black didn't move, Clay glancing up to see that the drake's gaze was now fixed on the crystal, not with rage, but rapt fascination.
"How do we shut it down?"
Clay's voice trailed off as his gaze returned to the crystal, finding it snared by the dark, light-swallowing void at the center. "Like a hole in the world," he thought before he fainted. "Something you can fall into."
You look older.
Clay blinked, finding his eyes filled with bright sunlight and his head buzzing with disorientation. He staggered a little, steadying as a hand gripped his elbow.
Quite a trick you've pulled this time, Clayton,
a young female voice said.
Making your way in here. You must tell me how you did it.
He blinked again, and his vision cleared to reveal the small, oval face of a diminutive woman about his own age. Despite her youth, he knew her instantly. It was the eyes, as bright, open, and inquisitive as he remembered, and the half-smile playing on her lips. It held a hint of mockery, but betrayed mostly the simple affection of greeting a valued friend.
Miss Ethie,
he said, the name emerging in a laugh as he drew her into an embrace.
Just Ethlyn will do, she said,
voice muffled against his shoulder.
As I told you before.
She drew back, eyes searching his face as a frown put a single line in her otherwise smooth forehead.
How long has it been since?
She grimaced and shrugged.
Well, you know.
Months, he said, his joy muted by the knowledge that this was a trance. Another ghost, he thought, like Silverpin. He looked around, seeing a tall mountain range. It wasn't the grim majesty of the Coppersoles or the jungle giants of the Karnstats. Here the air was far colder, and the peaks not as tall, and placed closer together, to create a maze of deeply weathered stone. The landscape had a gnarled, twisted appearance, conveying an impression of ruin, even though there was no sign of civilization.
Only months?
Ethlyn asked, gaze still roaming his face.
You really need to take better care of yourself.
A lot happened after you left.
And not for the good, I assume.
He shook his head and gestured at their surroundings. I've never been here, he said. Wherever it is, how can I craft a trance from somewhere I've never seen? A smile returned, the mockery more in evidence now.
You haven't. This isn't your mind. It's Lutheran's.
Clay took another survey of the mountain range, finding it as perfect a mindscape as he had ever seen. Even Lazanne would have had trouble matching the precision of detail, the slight variation in the chilled air. But he saw no vestige of Drake perception in it. His trances with Jack and the Drake memories Ethlyn had shared gave him an understanding of how they perceived the world, and it wasn't like this. No Drake saw this, he said. This is a human memory.
Quite right. How perceptive you've become.
She turned, moving to the edge of the broad summit on which they stood.
The crag mines of Western Aradzia, she said, spreading her arms wide. As captured by my very own eyes quite some time ago, when I was still spry enough to climb all the way up here. Fascinating geography, don't you think? No one's really all that sure how they formed. There is evidence of glaciation, but that's only a partial explanation.
I got a new friend who might be able to help with that, he muttered, fighting a sudden lurch in his chest as he watched her take in the view. She seemed so real, so alive, it inevitably summoned memories of her death, a death he hadn't been able to prevent. A ghost, he reminded himself, living in Lutheran's mind like Silverpin lived in mine. The white, he began, but she waved him to silence.
I do seem to recall you're doing your damnedest to ensure I didn't follow you, she said.
If you hadn't, maybe you'd be talking to my ghost just now.
Ghost?
She pursed her lips.
A name that fits, I suppose. Though I would hate to think Lutheran feels he's being haunted.
It was you. You kept him by me after the White Rose.
Not entirely. I merely encouraged an impulse that was already there. He does seem to like you, you know. Thank you for making him leave, by the way. he would certainly have perished on the ice. Least I could do.
He looked around at the mountains once more. Was it the heart blood? Is that what kept you here?
Lutheran and I shared minds for many years. I suppose I am the echo of that connection.
She beckoned to him and started to descend the steep, rocky slope below the summit.
Come on, I would like you to see something.
Clay followed her, traversing a series of narrow ledges and granite boulders protruding from the mountainside. Ethlyn appeared almost childlike as she hopped from ledge to boulder, with all the sure-footed skill of someone who had followed this course many times. Clay was markedly more careful, forcing her to loiter with amused impatience as he navigated the often damp rock.
You never did like heights, as I recall, she observed. It does rather make one wonder, though. I mean, would it make any difference if you fell? We are both just a collection of memories. It's not like we have any bones to break.
Feel free to try it, they replied, inching his way along a ledge. I ain't too keen on finding out.
No, me either.
She leapt nimbly onto a granite outcrop and paused to peer down.
But it's strange that it hasn't occurred to me before. All the time spent in this place, and I've never been tempted to just jump and see if I go splat.
Maybe Lutheran won't let you. It's his head. Guess he makes the rules. A 10-minute descent brought them to a narrow crevice where the flank of the mountain leveled out. An infant black crouched at the edge of the fissure, small wings and tail twitching as it peered into the depths, a series of soft plaintive grunts issuing from its snout.
This is where I found him,
Ethlyn said, moving to crouch a short distance from the keening infant.
All those years ago.
The infant whirled at her approach, a warning hiss emerging from its mouth. It seemed to have no awareness of Clay, its gaze fixed on Ethlyn, jaws snapping as she extended a hand holding a morsel of meat. Clay moved to the edge of the crevice, looking down to see the large, crumpled form of an adult black far below.
He was barely 2 days old when the contractors killed her, Ethlyn said. I couldn't just leave him to perish, but there was only one way to save him, and it scared me.
Heart blood, Clay said, eyes lingering on the Drake corpse. I had my own taste not long ago. Ain't got any plans to repeat it any time soon.
You drank heart blood?
Ethlyn straightened, a mix of sympathy and fascination on her face.
What species?
Blue. A great and fearsome blue of terrible reputation. He died.
I'm sorry.
Clay nodded, casting a final glance at the dead Drake and moving away. We got things to talk about, he said. Plans to make.
Plans?
Yeah. War plans. The White's got itself an army now, and they're killing a lot of people. Those they don't kill, they turn into spoiled. We're fighting it, but things ain't going so well.
And you want Lutheran to join your war?
Not just him. The blacks. All of them. They fought it before, we know that. We need them to fight it again and finish it this time. Ethlyn folded her arms, her head tilting and lips pursing in an expression he knew indicated her fearsome mind was hard at work.
Just how did you get in here, Clayton?
She asked.
You still haven't told me.
He looked down, exerting his own will in a brief experiment, as he wasn't sure he possessed any power here. The rock beneath his feet obligingly turned to moon dust, a portion of which he raised and molded into the black crystal.
What is that?
Ethlyn asked, moving closer to extend a finger to one of the glowing spikes. They assumed it had been quite some time since she had seen something so completely unfamiliar.
Be easier to show you, he said,
expanding his will further. The surrounding mountains transformed into the forest that greeted him when he first stepped into the strange world beneath the ice. Welcome to the last enclave of the Phelos caste.
Incredible.
Ethlyn let out a small laugh as the enclave faded around them, shifting back into the Cragmines. He had shown her all of it, every scrap of memory he could summon regarding the enclave, every morsel of information he had acquired.
All those years in the interior,
Ethlyn went on, shaking her head.
I had no idea, no clue whatsoever. I thought the temple builders must have been the first people to walk this continent. But all the wonders they crafted were just an echo of something greater.
She paused, summoning the vision of the black crystal he had shared. Ethlyn's gaze darkened as she stared at the glowing spikes revolving around the void.
Or perhaps, she said, it was something worse, something best consigned to the past.
We need it, Clay insisted. We need it to ally with the blacks.
Ally or enslave? The ancients did remarkable things, but committed the most vile acts in the process. There are memories in here, deep and very old. So nightmarish and confused, it's hard to make sense of them. And they're so painful, I only tried once. Were I to delve deeper, would I find your friend there, scalpel in hand?
Clay saw little point in denial. Yeah, he said. She'd be there. But she ain't what she used to be. None of us are. And it don't change the fact that we got a war to fight. When the white's done with us, you know it'll come for them. It remembers and it don't forgive. Lutheran and all his kin will have to fight it anyways. With us, they got a better chance. The rock beneath their feet began to shudder, and the sky darkened from misty gray to red-tinged black. A cacophony of fracturing rock assailed Clay's ears as the mountains began to twist and grow. Cliff faces became wings and boulders claws. What had been a jagged ridge slowly revealed itself as the spiny neck of a huge drake. They rose all around, wings spreading, tails and necks uncoiling. The crescendo of shattered stone subsided into a low murmur, reminding Clay of distant thunder, as the host of giant drakes lowered their heads to regard him, eyes shining with a bright red glow.
It's not me you need to convince, Clayton, Ethlyn told him. It's them.
Chapter 32 Lizanne.
Remarkable,
Alzar Lakaris said, looking at the photostats arrayed on the Viable's wardroom table. They had been taken by a nervous young man who had emerged from the ranks of the Mountworks employees some days before, camera in hand, to offer his services. He was an apprentice photostatist, who increasingly found the life of a manufacturing worker less than pleasant. It had been Captain Trumaine's notion to pack him onto the Typhoon for a reconnaissance flight to the north. The aerostat was able to hover in place long enough for an exposure of decent length, and Jemiah provided the required chemicals and equipment to develop the plates. The result was a visual record of northern Verestia, far more accurate than any map. Imperial cartographers having neglected the area through fear of banditry for many years.
You can see the passes clearly,
Alzar went on, finger-tapping 3 points on a series of photostats that had been aligned to produce a continuous image. It captured the central span of the mountain range, dominating the region the Verestians refer to as the Neck. There were 3 channels through the mountains, each separated by a 10-mile gap, with the largest and most easily traversed one in the center. This was known as the Grand Cut, whilst the Eastern Pass was the Small Cut, and the Western, the Little Cut.
The gateways to the peninsula, Alzar went on. They used to be fortified, but the defenses were destroyed by the Corventines during the occupation. No one's bothered to repair them since.
Meaning the enemy's line of advance is wide open, Trumaine said. There were only three of them in the wardroom. Alzar, acting as the sole representative for the host of Verestian captains who had deserted Ithilda and Arshap's authority. A dozen pirate vessels and armed freighters had arrived in Blaska Sound that morning. Alzar duly came ashore with a delegation to inform Lizanne that he was now Admiral of the Verestian Defense League, before inquiring as to the progress of his niece's education. She does very well, Lizanne assured him, gesturing to where Morva waited nearby. Feel free to ask her yourself.
Business comes first, he said, after the briefest glance in Morva's direction. Here, he went on, handing Lizanne a folded document. I know how you corporate types like your contracts.
The contract terms were sparse and simple. The Mountworks Manufacturing Company would supply weapons and personnel to assist in the defense of the Verestian Peninsula, in return for continued safe harbor within Blaska Sound, and provision of food and medical supplies guaranteed by the Verestian Defense League. There was no mention of patents, shares, or allocation of future profits. Lizanne thought it a clumsily worded document, but, as she doubted it would ever require scrutiny before an arbitration court in any case, was happy to sign it there on the wharf.
Not necessarily, she told Trumaine now, sliding another photostat across the table, showing a magnified view of the Grand Cut.
The image had been captured at a slight angle, giving an impression of the steepness of the cliffs rising on either side of the track that snaked through the pass.
Even without fortifications, the terrain would seem to offer a singular opportunity to a defender.
With your aerial contraption, we could shift some cannon onto the clifftops, Alzar agreed after a moment's consideration. And your newfangled guns. Any army that tries to make it through will suffer a fearful toll.
You forget their command of the air, Trumaine said. We know the enemy is far from stupid. They'll send drakes to secure the clifftops before marching through.
His gaze narrowed as he turned it on Lizanne.
I believe Miss Lethbridge has another stratagem in mind.
I do, Lizanne said, playing a hand across the three passes. We use explosive to block the small and little cuts, leaving the grand cut open.
She pointed to the northern end of the pass.
We will still have to mount a meaningful defense, but it will take the form of a fighting withdrawal, so as to draw the White's forces in, and we'll need all the blood blessed in our ranks and all the product we can gather to make it work.
I brought 23 blood blessed, Alzar said, but only half can be spared. The rest are needed to power the few blood burners we possess. As for product, he grimaced and shrugged. Stocks are thinner by the day, and those that hold them loathe to sell except at extortionate prices.
Write promissory notes, Lizanne advised. Make the Mountworks Manufactory the guarantor if you like. If that fails, the stocks will just have to be seized. The time for observing the legal niceties of trade is over.
She turned back to the photostats, a finger tracing to a point two-thirds of the way along the Grand Cut.
The pass is at its narrowest here, she said, and overlooked by a promontory. I propose that we prepare the promontory with explosives, and once the bulk of the White's army reaches this point, we bring it down. All three passes will be blocked, and we will have killed a large number of enemy troops.
It won't stop them, Trumaine said. The passes can still be cleared, and the White will be sure to gather more strength to clear the rubble.
It will buy us time, Lizanne replied. As for the White's ability to gather strength, I have an idea about that.
She watched Tinkerer's face closely as Macario lifted his hands from the pianola and the last note faded. The Follies of Savokas, according to the musician's judgment, was as inane and trite a piece of musical doggerel as he had ever heard. However, Once he had reproduced the entire score on paper, close examination of the text revealed one short melody of interest in the third act. It was hidden in a lyrically dense song known as Sivokas the Genius, in which the ever-pompous titular character reeled off a list of his intellectual achievements accompanied by a jaunty high-tempo tune. Once the tempo was slowed, something far more elegant and familiar began to emerge.
"It's definitely her," Macario reported. "Empress Azarez's handiwork, concealed within a comic operetta of little distinction. It's rather like finding a pearl in a pile of turds."
"A shared joke, perhaps," Bazan mused, her gaze still lingering on Tinkerer, his face as pale and immobile as before. "A secret between lovers." She imagined Azarair playing the tune for Alastine, first at the original speed, then faster, perhaps improvising the lyrics. "How they must have giggled together," she thought. "Another secret shared between the princess and the fiddly girl."
"When this is over," she said to Macario, "you might want to examine some other operettas of the period. I suspect Azarair penned quite a few."
"Doctor," she went on, glancing at Dr. Weygrand, "if you would, please." Madame Hackigan had given over a large two-story building for use as the settlement's clinic, though it had required considerable repair and cleaning before Dr. Weygrand consented to occupy it. Tinkerer had been placed in an upstairs room, along with a pianola, where Macario labored to craft the music that might wake him. However, the artificer remained as immobile as ever, forcing Lazanne to conclude that another trance was required. The doctor betrayed some hesitation before moving to the bottle suspended from a metal stand at Tinkerer's bedside. The bottle contained a mix of saline and powdered nutrients, needed to keep the comatose patient alive these past weeks. A rubber tube trailed from it, ending in a needle inserted into the vein in Tinkerer's forearm. Despite the attentions of Dr. Weygrand and his small staff of orderlies, Tinkerer had grown ever more thin and pale as the days went by, and Lazanne didn't need any expert advice to deduce he didn't have many more left.
"The last trance didn't do him much good," Weygrand pointed out.
He had prepared a syringe of blue, high-quality ironship product, provided by Alzar Lacaris, but seemed reluctant to push the needle into the cork seal at the base of the bottle.
"Who's to say the next one won't kill him?"
"He's already dying," Lazanne said, "and we need him. Please proceed, Doctor." Weygrand nodded, swallowing a sigh as he depressed the plunger on the syringe, sending a cloud of amber fluid into the bottle. Lazanne waited until the product had faded, indicating it was all now running through Tinkerer's veins, then gestured for Macario to play the tune once more. She unstoppered her own vial of blue and kept careful watch on Tinkerer's face as the melody filled the room. At first, there was no reaction. Then she saw the faint circular shadow on his closed lids as his eyes began to move, a clear signal of a dream state.
"This may take some time," she said, raising the vial to her lips.
"I'm not going anywhere," Macario promised, which made her smile, just as the room disappeared and she found herself in darkness. At first, she thought she had been cast into a void, some black vacuum left by Tinkerer's vanished mind. But then she saw a burst of yellow flame directly ahead. It was bright enough to illuminate the uneven walls of the tunnel in which she stood, at the same time filling it with a roar of pain and rage of sufficient volume to force her to clamp her hands over her ears. The flame faded along with the roar, although this time the darkness wasn't so absolute. The flames had evidently found a target, judging by the flickering glow rising from a dark shape lying at what she recognized as the end of this tunnel. Lazanne started forward, then stopped as her foot came close to tripping over something. Looking down, she saw the disordered and scaled features of a spoiled, slackened in death.
Alistine's friend from the clearing, she realized,
recognizing the monochrome war paint on the spoiled's face.
Tree speaker.
Another gout of flame snapped her gaze to the end of the tunnel, although the roar that accompanied it was far weaker now. As the flames faded, she heard a ragged rasp of indrawn breath, followed by a high-pitched rattle that told of a drake in immense pain. Remembering Alistine's warning about the real risk of injury in this trance, she waited until the rattle had died away before starting forward again. Sinking to her haunches at the end of the tunnel, she crouched close to the wall and peered out at a huge cavern, the floor of which featured a tower of some kind.
Bone tower, she surmised,
recalling Clay's shared memories of the White's lair and Arbaris's tale of his expeditions to the interior. The tower rose from the center of a scorched circle on the cavern floor. Slumped against its base was a white drake, blood seeping in a thick stream from the large iron spike protruding from its ribcage. It let out a plaintive moan as Lazanne stepped out from the tunnel, but seemed to show no sign of noticing her presence, tail coiling in twitches of diminishing intensity. Lazanne judged its size as perhaps half that of the beast Clay had found beneath the copper soles, which still made it larger than an adult red and comparable to a youthful black. The only light came from the flaming corpse lying a few yards within the scorched circle. The flames had consumed it so completely, it was impossible to tell if it had been human or spoiled. Lazanne gave a start as a cascade of dust descended from above, along with a shower of displaced stones. Her gaze jerked upwards to the roof of the cavern, her ears detecting the sound of claws frantically skittering on stone.
We thought there would only be one.
Lazanne spun in alarm as Alistine stepped into the light, offering a grin of welcome that seemed impossibly broad, too many teeth gleaming in the glow of the fire.
Burned,
Lazanne realized as Alistine turned her gaze upward. Much of the flesh around her lower jaw and upper neck had been seared, along with her left ear. The impossible grin was in fact the result of half her lips having been burned away.
Actually, there were two,
Alistine went on, speaking in a wet rasp.
A male and a female, and she was pregnant. I had hoped her wounds were fatal.
She pointed at a stream of blood visible in the continuing cascade of dust and stone.
That she would crawl away and die somewhere along with the egg growing in her womb. But in my heart, I knew it could never be that simple.
Her gaze settled on the dying male wight.
I had to know. Excuse me a moment.
Alistine abruptly collapsed onto her hands and knees and began a slow, painful crawl towards the dying wight. It lay almost immobile now, chest rising and falling in ever slower and more labored breaths, but its eyes were still bright, Lazanne recognizing the hate in its gaze as Alistine crawled near.
One of my last inventions,
she said upon reaching the beast's side, her voice free of the pain that made her arm tremble, as she raised it to grip the iron spike protruding from the ribcage.
Or rediscoveries, to be fully accurate. The ancients had an alloy that could pierce anything if fashioned into a point and projected with sufficient force. I had enough black for a killing thrust, but we only had one spear.
She gripped the spike tighter and jerked it, provoking a convulsive thrash from the white. Blood steamed in the heat blossoming from its maw as it raised its head, neck coiling in a final attempt to roast its tormentor. Alistine raised herself up, grunting with the effort of twisting the spike, then driving it deeper. The white's last flame subsided into smoke, its head thudding onto the stone floor. The tail and the wings continued to twitch, but the dull, empty gleam of its eyes told the tale clearly.
Tree Speaker's people carried the old stories, Alastine said, slumping against the dead drake's flank. Treasured them throughout the ages. At first, I could scarcely believe what they told me. The white was real, and once it came close to burning this continent to ash, perhaps the rest of the world into the bargain. So great was its malice that it twisted the people here, made them into deformed two-legged versions of itself, a whole continent of willing slaves. But there were those who resisted, kept the kernel of humanity burning within themselves, and in time they fought back, with the help of the blacks. How? Lazan said, moving closer to crouch at the artisan's side. How did they beat it? The white could control all drakes but the blacks. It could control humans it spoiled, but not the blood-blessed. It needed something to match them, match their abilities, but it never found it. Through battle and guile and courage, the blood-blessed freed enough spoiled to ally with the blacks and bring it down. Though by the time the war was won, their civilization that once flourished here had fallen to rubble. The enslaved spoiled, maddened by the loss of their god, hunted their free enemies mercilessly. After decades and centuries of persecution, only Tree Speaker and his tribe were left.
Alastine cast a stricken, wet-eyed glance at the burning corpse lying close by.
Meeting me sealed their fate. When I told them I had deciphered writings telling of an ancient white sleeping in the caverns beneath this temple, they had no choice but to follow me. Every warrior they sent died here, meaning their young will be defenseless. The other spoiled will destroy them now. But what else could I do?
She turned to Lazan, tears streaming from her eyes into her ruined flesh.
It couldn't be allowed to rise again. They knew that.
She held Lazan's gaze, beseeching some kind of absolution. But Lazan was not a priest.
What did it need?
She said, seeing the distress on Alastine's face dissipate at the hardness of her tone.
You said it needed something to match the blood-blessed. What was it?
What else could it be?
The artisan said with a shrug.
A blood-blessed of its own, of course. One with the right kind of mind.
What kind of mind?
Alastine blinked and turned away, grunting in pain as she shifted closer to the rivulet of blood still flowing from the wound the iron spike had torn in the white's hide.
Madness is a common trait amongst humans, she said. But the non-blessed are many, and we are few. And it needed to be the right pitch of madness, colored with enough cruelty, envy and resentment, to see what it intended for the world as right and just. All those centuries ago, it never found the right mind. In your time, it would be more fortunate.
She leaned closer to the stream of blood, face tense in expectation and fear.
You drank, Lazan said.
You drank and saw that it would rise again.
I saw.
Alastine lifted a trembling hand and touched her fingers to the blood, wincing as the tips turned white in the flow.
Many things, Lazan. Terrible and beautiful, cruel and kind. For that is life, and I saw it all. But there was a greater gift to be had here.
She reached into her pocket and drew out a flask, drinking down the contents in a few gulps before tossing it aside. Lazan saw the strength flood Alastine's body as the green took hold, the woman rising to her feet and taking a firmer grip on the iron spike with both hands. A few hard tugs and she had drawn it out, raising it to let the diminishing flames play on the dark, near-black substance on the spearpoint tip.
"The heart blood of a white," she said. "For someone who had spent much of her life seeking knowledge, how could I resist it?"
Alistine pressed her ruined mouth to the spearpoint, jerking in agony as the blood made its way past her exposed teeth and down her throat. The cavern disappeared, leaving them floating in what Lazanne at first took for some kind of giant fishbowl. Forms swirled around them, some indistinct, others vibrant and shimmering with color. They were constantly shifting, a formless, misty swirl one second, then a human face or a fully realized body, sometimes naked, sometimes clothed. There were men and women, infants and elderly. Lazanne realized she could hear them, a thousand voices babbling at once. Not voices, she realized. Thoughts. These are minds.
"Indeed they are,"
Alistine said. She floated close by, whole and beautiful once again, a mix of wonder and dismay on her face as she surveyed the swirling minds.
"Every blood-blessed drawing breath at the moment I drank the white's blood. And they were all mine. All I had to do was reach out and take one."
One of the shimmering minds veered towards them, Zan recognizing the face of a woman in the misty shape.
"Curious thing about heart blood," Alistine mused. "The abilities it conveys never fade. They are seared into your being, an eternal gift, or a curse, and one that can be shared."
She flicked her hand, and the woman's mind flew away, soon lost amongst the multitude.
"This is how you called the first one to you in Skorazin," Lazanne said, "and how he called the next." "Yes, a great and unforgivable sin, but one I had to commit if this world was to survive. There wasn't just heart blood on the spear. I saw what was coming, and I saw you, and I saw the clever boy, and knew it was my role to bring you together."
The huge fishbowl turned into a gray mist, which soon coalesced into something familiar. Lazanne found herself regarding walls of uneven stone, lit by the light of an oil lamp. She turned at the sound of scraping chalk, and saw Tinkerer at the smooth patch of wall he used as a blackboard. The flat surface was covered in an incomprehensible melange of numbers and formulae, some of it so dense the stone was completely covered in chalk. He gave no sign of having noticed Lazanne's presence, his hand moving in a blur as it added yet more wisdom to the wall.
"It wasn't like this when I lived here,"
Alistine said in a croak, appearing at Lazanne's side.
"The others must have enlarged it over the years."
A form had recovered its wounds, though the burns appeared much older now, the scars pink and mottled, rather than puckered and blackish red. Lazanne could see wrinkles on her undamaged skin, and she stood with a pronounced stoop, grey hair hanging over her ruined face in slack, unwashed tendrils.
"How did you come to be here?" Lazanne asked. "I wrote a letter to an old friend when I returned to the Empire."
Alistine moved to peer at Tinkerer's wall, frowning in bafflement.
"And I thought I was clever," she muttered. "Azareth," Lazanne said. "She put you here." "It was what I asked for. Somewhere to hide and remain hidden for all time. A reward for all the marvelous trinkets I brought back from Marazia." She was effusive in her thanks and prompt in granting my request, but never came for a visit. Not that I blame her. No doubt the Imperial agents who escorted me here gave her a fulsome report on my appearance. Hey,
Boy!
She snapped her fingers beside Tinkerer's ear.
Not polite to ignore your guests, you know.